Sports. Sportsnet 590. The Fan.
On the Fan Morning Show, Sportsnet 590, The Fan, JD Bunkus, Ailish Forfire, Baby Friday, 2 days post deadline. The Jays conversations are never quieting down up here. Let's hear what the reaction was elsewhere from Bo Porter, former MLB outfielder and manager and current MLB Network analyst. Good morning, Bo.
Good morning, Ailish. Thank you so much.
Oh, no problem. Thanks for joining the show. Obviously, we're up here in Blue Jays land. We're in the bubble of our quiet deadline, so to speak. How was this received elsewhere? Were people surprised with what little the Blue Jays did?
Well, I think, you know, a lot of times when you look at teams and the acquisitions that are made at the trade deadline, I always start with the current roster. And when you look at this current roster that's in win now mode, it's a roster that is capable of making the playoffs. So whenever you start adding pieces, you have to also realize that in order to add pieces, you're going to have to subtract pieces. And I don't think the Blue Jays had too many pieces to subtract from their team. And therefore, that's why I think you saw the moves that were made.
What were your conversations like with people, though? Like, did you find yourself being a little bit more defensive of them? Because, again, yeah, you're a former big league manager, and you are probably looking at it like, okay, if I was managing this team, what am I taking in? What am I doing? One thing you can always do is add pitching, right? Like, I'm sure that there's never been a baseball team that you've ever seen. There's never been a baseball team you've been a part of that you didn't say, wow, we could use more pitching. And they didn't get a lot of that. They got an injury yesterday to Ross Stripling, which automatically promotes one of their, a guy that was supposed to potentially be a long man for them. I'm kind of curious as to the kind of general consensus you thought people had on them, or if they even came up at all because it was so quiet.
Well, when you talk about acquisitions, all acquisitions come at a cost. So you have to ask yourself, when you look at even the new current format of the playoffs, the reality of understanding, do we have enough to catch the Yankees? Do we have enough to win the division? If that's not the case, then now you put yourself in a wild card situation. And when you start to look at your organization, yes, everyone wants to win a World Series. Everyone wants to be in the playoffs. But you have to be realistic of your chances of winning the World Series with this particular team or roster. Now, anything can happen if you get into the dance. But you don't completely sacrifice your future if realistically, I'll give you the San Diego Padres, for example. The San Diego Padres made the move that they made for Juan Soto because if you look at their roster and if Tatis comes back healthy, they have a chance to win it all because of their roster and the players playing to their capability. So it's always tricky, but I think from an executive standpoint, and trust me, JD, I haven't always been at this place because I've spent so much time on the field. It's the experience that I've been able to gain by moving into the front office with John Hart in Atlanta and really starting to understand the overall development of the organization and looking at it from a global view.
You know what, Bo? I was going to say, like, you kind of sold out all the guys that you were a manager, you were an outfielder, and now you're a suit. You know, you're like, listen, these are pricey acquisitions here. You guys got to think about what it's going to take for us up in the front office, come prospect capital. We can't help you guys this year. We can't do this. I do wonder, though, from managerial experience, like that part of you, what you think about for a guy like John Schneider, who's entered this situation where, you know, he's beside the guy that gets fired. He steps in right away. The team starts having success. And it feels kind of like you're in this a bit of a limbo where you're going, hey, maybe I'm the team's manager for the long-term future. Maybe it's going to depend on this team's success. How much pressure do you think is on John Schneider here with a team where, there's been a firing in season? Do you think that it's easier because there's a grace period? Do you think it's harder because now there's like a little bit more attention on you because you are new and it's fresh? Where are you at with just kind of like the situation he stepped into?
First of all, managing Major League Baseball is never easy. So it doesn't matter if you are in the chair for 10 years or if you're in the chair, it's your first day. It's not an easy job just because of all of the things in which surround the job of managing Major League Baseball. I think when you look at an in-season change at the manager position, to me, it's actually easier for someone who's been in spring training with that ball club, who's been around the players, because you don't have the situation where it is a complete get to know and the understanding of how you want to use these guys. For coaches that's on any staff, and I always said this to all of my coaches, you actually should sit there from a coaching standpoint and imagine yourself as the manager, because those are conversations that the manager should have with his staff. What do you think about this move? What do you think about that move? So moving from the number two spot to the number one spot, from a game planning standpoint, it should not have been too much of a difference. I think the biggest difference now is he finds himself in a more communicating position because he's now the liaison between the front office and the field staff and the players.
So what do you think managing today is like? Because we have a lot of conversations when mistakes get made, or, you know, we saw this a couple of years ago in World Series, right? Kevin Cash, he's manager of the year, and then a spreadsheet tells him this is the move that I have to make. And we're always told, like, and we were told with Charlie Montoyo, hey, the information is there, it's available to you, but ultimately you get the final say. Do you actually feel that way? Do you feel like managers, most of them around baseball, actually feel like they have the final say when it comes to decision making with these baseball teams and like what actually happens from a strategical standpoint? Or do you think that's already like pre-decided for them and that the job is essentially more player management than it is in-game decision making?
I think that in order to be successful, it has to be a collaborated effort. And that collaborated effort has to be with the mutual respect of everybody's position. Whether you're a field staff, whether you're the field staff or whether you're the front office, you have to respect each person's position and the work that goes into why they believe that the decision that should be made in game, that's something that is discussed prior to the game. But at the end of the day, when you get into the game, one of the jobs of the manager is knowing how to use the information in the toolbox in real time. Because everything that is in front of you on paper, it has already happened. Now, how does that stack up to what's happening in front of me today? And that's our job, to be able to marry those two in real time.
So, sorry.
I was just going to say, because I'm always, like, that was one of the questions I had with bringing in John Schneider, right? Is like, do you start to just bring in your manager because he does things the way you want it done? Or do you want to bring in a manager who has a different voice than you, who might, you know, have a dissenting opinion? Because, yeah, I think that that's a real spot of confusion for fans today, is they go, what exactly is the manager's role? And I don't think that it's as clear as it's been in years past.
Yes, and it changes with organization. That's why the respect factor is so important. The collaboration factor is so important. Like, I can remember the early days when I was in Houston, and as a first time manager, you're getting all of this information, and you're asking yourself, how much of it should I use? How much of it should I not use? How much of my own baseball experience and baseball IQ should I use? And as time go on, what I can tell you from year one to year two, the information became even more and more valuable. And I felt like I was getting better at my job because I understood how to use the information. Like, I'll give you an example you know, we were in Seattle one day, and they had Raul Ibanez, who had always been a professional hitter. And we had a righty and we had a lefty in the bullpen that was available. I knew at some point they were going to pop Raul Ibanez. So I get both a lefty up, Wesley Wright, and then I get a righty up, Josh Zide. As both of them are getting ready and the game is starting to unfold, we're winning the game by two or three runs. And Raul Ibanez is the bat that I know. If they get an opportunity to take a shot at popping this game, he's going to be the guy. Well, they pinch hit Raul Ibanez. Now, the analytics will tell you that Raul Ibanez is hitting 160 off of left-handers. Now, I'm looking at my left-hander in Wesley Wright, and he's 88 to 90. It's a sinking fastball that runs right back into Raul Ibanez's hotspot, which is the loop on a down and in. He throws a slider that's a ball-to-ball slider that he depends on chase in order to get the hitter to swing. Well, I know Raul Ibanez. He's not going to chase it, so he's either going to end up walking him or hanging a breaking ball or throwing him the fastball that runs back into the loop. Whereas on the other hand, I had Josh Zide down there, and if you look at Raul Ibanez's heat map, he struggles with velocity at the top of the zone. Now, but if you look at right-handers, Raul Ibanez was hitting 360 off of righties. So the safe move is to bring in the lefty because you can justify it. Well, he's hitting 160 off of lefties. The lefty just didn't get the job done. Well, I bring in Josh Zide, go out to the mound. Listen, This guy has a hole at the top of the zone. I want fastballs at the top of the zone. If you throw your split, it better bounce. I'll see you in the dugout after you strike this guy out. Josh Zide comes in. He goes 95 fastball top of the zone, 95 fastball top of the zone, split, bounce, fastball top of the zone, strike three. He comes into the dugout. Mm-hmm. That's using the numbers and the analytics kind of against the grid, but understanding why you're bringing in the offhand pitcher. So, yes, the numbers are there. The information is there. Our job as the manager is to understand how to use those numbers to put players mm-hmm. in position to be successful.
So you did manage a Blue Jay, George Springer, in 2014. So you can give us some perspective on his growth, at least, as a player. And one thing that we talk about a lot up here, as we speculate, is that he's one of those great, one of those big locker room presence, a guy that is a good leader. Are we on to something there with our outside perspective with George Springer?
Great human being. I'm one of those people that subscribe to the theory. You sign players, you invest in people. The Blue Jays have a great investment in George Springer. When you think about George Springer, what he brings to a ball club is, and I use this terminology, a player that tilts the field. Meaning, when he's in your lineup every day, he tilts the field into your favor because he can put a team on his back and carry them at any moment. Not only that, when you look at what he means in the clubhouse, he's one of those spirited guys that keeps the locker room loose. He's going to lead by example. And the energy that he brings to the ballpark each and every day is championship energy.
It certainly feels that way in his short time here. I mean, even the players are you know, appreciative. I think we got a lot of young players here on the Blue Jays. So it's good to have a veteran presence that helps kind of usher them in, showing what it's like to be.
And he's been there. I mean, he's been to the promised land. I mean, he went through the rebuild in Houston. So a lot of times you have to be able to make it through all of the losses to get to the wins. And George is a product of that. He made it through those tough times in Houston and understand what it takes to win a championship at the major league level.
Well, I hope that he gets another chance very soon here in Toronto. Bo, we really appreciate your insight this morning, and thanks so much for joining us.
Yes, thank you guys so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
No problem. Bo Porter, former MLB outfielder and manager and current MLB Network analyst.
So is Like, for a guy like Bo Porter, he would have managed George Springer when he was a child, right?
Like a rookie. I think he was rookie year.
Exactly. I think you'll always see people like that, right? So now for him to be the vet, right, on the team, he's the vet. He's the old man on the team. He's the 33-year-old. Older than anyone else. No one's as old as old George Springer.
Actually, you're older, so.
Sure. I know. It's painful. I'm getting to the point where I'm going to have to start paying attention. Like, I'm on the cusp of, not less so with Major League Baseball, because there's always, you know, a 40-year-old hanging out around in Major League Baseball. But I'm on the cusp in a lot of the other sports for, oh, there's no longer guys older than me.
You'd be getting 1 year league minimum deals if you're in the NHL.
As long as LeBron is around, older than me, still one of the best players in basketball, there's still hope for me. You know,
like I don't. Tom Brady too.
No, but Tom Brady's
different.
His
birthday yesterday, actually.
No, yeah. What? I love how you said that. It was his birthday, actually. I was like, wow.
Whoa, he has birthday.
Tom Brady has a birthday. I have a birthday too.
It's too bad it wasn't August 4th, the best birthday in the world.
Yeah, he was so close.
August 3rd is way worse.
So close. He was so close. Yeah, Tom Brady's 45 years old. Mm-hmm. Yeah, thing is I don't. Tom Brady's an alien. I don't think about Tom Brady like the rest of us. I don't, and not like I think about LeBron that way too. Did you see that picture of Insigne? I think is the TFC guy shaking his LeBron's hand.
No.
Yeah, it's amazing.
I'm really
he's trying to shake LeBron's hand, and he's just
My god!
He just grabs his,
no
like,
way.
Yes, I know. He grabs like two fingers for the handshake. It's a tough look. It's a tough look for Insigne.
Tough one. Everyone Google
I know.
That.
Yeah, it's a big L. It's a big L for TFC. Honestly, it's TFC's biggest L of the year. It's really hard for, like, it's going to be really hard for Insigne to do something here soccer-wise that will top that brutal handshake. It's not what you want to see. But yeah, Tom Brady is just, he's 45 is not a thing. I'm not thinking we're going to start to see pro athletes playing in their mid-40s. And with Tom Brady, I was thinking about this yesterday with all the Dolphin stuff. Mm-hmm. I still wonder if he'll retire after this year. I still wonder if there's a part of him that's going to be unsatisfied with not getting to close out his career the way that he wanted to, which is, I think, with the Miami Dolphins. And now it would be pretty sus.
Yeah, you think?
Well, because here's the crazy thing about this. Actually, you know what? I'm just going to turn this into something to chew on. This is something to chew on, brought to you by Great Canadian Meats.
Yum, yum, yum.
I was going to talk about Saints rookie Trevor Penning, who is now my actual favorite.
He's your favorite. Like, he's got to be top two.
Yeah. If you haven't heard about this guy, he's a top 20 pick. And he's been kicked out of practice 3 consecutive days for fighting. He's 6'7", I want to say. He's 6'7", he's 325. I love him. I would do anything to have this guy.
Jersey for your upcoming birthday.
I would do anything to have this guy on my football team. Are you kidding me? Like, he's just, he's that guy fighting with his teammates every single day. Apparently he can throw down a windmill dunk. and then he'll just, it's like you get in his face, he's going to scrap. I think this is the time. He's all ready to rock and roll here. But once you hit the regular season, I just know that the guy who's trying to fight 3 straight days, you're going to have to try to contain the care level there where you go, man, you got to have this where this guy isn't biting our team in the ass and he's not having, you know, the bad penalty where he smacks somebody at the wrong time and the other team, you know, it puts your team way behind the chains. But man, I don't know. I just love the guys that care that much. And just the thought that you're going to drop an O lineman onto the field, this guy, Northern Iowa, just geeked out dude who's 6'7 and just wants to fight everybody. And that's what he views offensive line as, is just sanctioned violence. I love it. I think that kid's going to be an absolute stud. It's going to be hard not to be. But yeah, Tom Brady. Why is it that he has not also been punished?
That's what I brought. Like, I completely agree. And I'm, you know, like, big Tom Brady. He's my favorite player. I love the Patriots.
I know you love him.
But
you love
honestly,
Brady.
Why is he just going out scot-free?
You know, can I give you my theory?
Yes.
So I don't know if this actually makes sense for the NFL's standpoint. Mm-hmm. I think there's two things at play as to why the public doesn't seem to give a crap. Other than one, actually, I'll give you three reasons. Number one, Patriots fans don't want to believe this is at all a thing. They don't want to talk about it because they're already, you know, holding on to a very, very, you know, they're holding on by a thread when it comes to trying to believe Tom Brady still cares about them or ever cared about them at all. And when he goes, New England special to me, they're like, yeah, thank you, Tom. But in reality, it's becoming more and more clear that, yeah, he didn't. No. It's been a while since Tom Brady cared about New England, and he's probably a little sour towards the organization. And yeah, that the relationship will forever be strained between he and the Patriots. He was flirting with somebody else while you guys were together. But it is what it is. That's not happy. That's not a guy that really cares about the New England legacy. So that, number one, Patriots fans do not want to talk about it. They're not interested in it. The main two reasons, though. That one's more just, you know, there's some truth to it, but it's not one of my main two. Number one is that I think because Tom Brady got so over-the-top punished in Deflategate that fans kind of look at it and go, well, what, he just went on a boat and talked about potentially doing some stuff in Miami? It's like, yeah, all right, what are they going to do, suspend him? He's already served his time, basically. But the third thing is that, yeah, everybody colludes. And if you're a guy like Tom Brady, who's at the end of his career and who's kind of done everything, I just don't think that anybody really cares. We're just used to this. We're used to Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving making a team in the middle of the season, getting James Harden to come join them. We're used to LeBron James openly campaigning to get Kyrie Irving over to Los Angeles. Like, we're used to stars trying to get one another to get to their destination and using any means possible to do it. The open tampering. Like, let's not forget Magic Johnson being on a late-night TV show getting fined for tampering, right, where he's talking about Paul George coming to Lakers. And I know that's more of a it really does feel like more of an NBA thing than another sports thing. So maybe football doesn't apply as much, but Tom Brady kind of goes into that echelon of just he's a superstar. We think about him. Quarterbacks, NBA superstars, it's a special category of team sport athlete. And so when it comes to recruiting, like, I don't know. I think this is just sort of the era that we live in. And someone looks at this and goes, I'd actually be more surprised if Tom Brady didn't talk to an owner of an NFL team on a yacht that was trying to convince him of coming and being a part-time owner of their organization. I think the only really shocking thing about that story was that, yeah, Brady was doing it while he was with the Patriots. And that if you're a Dolphins fan, you have to wonder, hey, did we actually have a shot? Could we have been the Bucks? Why weren't we the Bucks? Also, Tom didn't go there, so that's a little part of it too, mm-hmm. right? He didn't actually end up a Dolphin. If this had turned out that the Buccaneers were tampering with different Tom Brady story. In 2019, it would have been a little bit different. Sucks for the Dolphins, though. You're trying to get a little bit of momentum. There's some Tua buzz going down about his arm strength and how he's changed his throwing motion, or at least the base. Like, there's some more talk. Let's talk about Tua's hips a lot. He's hitting Tyreek in camp. He's got a cannon for an arm. People are saying he's got a stronger arm than even Patrick Mahomes. Yeah, you got a first-round pick. You got a new coach. That's the talk of the NFL in terms of sexy hires. And now you just lost a first-round pick. No one cares if the owner's suspended, by the way. No one cares. Let's take a break. Let's come back. Let's talk to former Raptor. Excited for this one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Damari Carroll. Remember him? JYD 2.0? He's going to be coaching now. He's heading to Milwaukee. He's joining Bud's staff. So we'll ask him how that kind of came about. We'll look back on some of his time in Toronto, maybe try to get a LeBron story out of him. Whole bunch. Very excited to talk to him.
You think we can convince him to help get Giannis to come to Toronto?
I think that would be a really bad way to start his Milwaukee Bucks career, is to come on Toronto Sports Radio and make promises about bringing Giannis to Toronto. I think that it's my guess. I can go out on a leap. He's not going to be... I can't remember the executive of the Dolphins that got hit with the harder fine. What's his name? Oh, anyways, who cares? I don't think he's going to be that for us with the Tom Brady thing. Anyway, let's take a break. Damari Carroll, former Raptor, next on the Fan Morning Show with J.D. Bunkus, Ailish 4-5, Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Back nine. Fan morning show. Again, I don't count the Ailish Hour because it's not my problem. It's not my problem. What do you got today on the Ailish Hour?
Ooh.
Anybody good?
Yeah, 1 second.
1 second? You don't know if I heart.
The thing is, I'm Julia Cruz, I believe. I want to make sure I say her name right. So I was going to ask Blake because she's.
That's a good. Hey, that was a veteran move by you to pretend like.
It's
oh,
true.
I didn't forget who was K-R-E-U-Z, on the show.
I just wanted to. So I just want to make sure that I can pronounce her name right. But yeah, Julia Cruz. So she's an MLB.com contributor. She's also on Sportsnet 5-9 The Fan. Cynthia Freeland, NFL Network.
Nice.
Ever heard of her?
I have.
We're going to talk some Deshaun Watson news. We're going to talk. Yeah. There's an NFL game tonight.
Yeah.
Jags and the Raiders.
Okay, so it's Blake's two teams.
I know. I'm so interested during the wake and rake to talk about that.
Tonight is the night
he's going to have a sweater on and the hat. He's got the Raiders hat. He's got the Jags hoodie.
Yeah, he's going to have the split jersey that we always make fun of, you know, the half and half. His newfound love, the Raiders, versus his old love, the Jacksonville Jaguars.
It's going to be tough.
Big day for Blake. You know, big day for Blake. Finds out Slamball is back and then his two football teams. Our next guest, I'm guessing, would have made a sweet Slamball player. Damari Carroll, former Raptors forward and current Milwaukee Bucks assistant coach. Congrats on the new gig. I don't know if you know Slamball is back, but it's making its return. Do you regret making your decision to become an assistant coach? Would you like, I think the opportunity is still here for you to renounce that new title and stake your claim as the biggest star to join Spikeball. Would you like to take
slam
that
ball's back, baby.
Slamball's back. Not Spikeball. Sorry, Slamball. Yeah, Spikeball is the beach game.
No, I'll pass on Slamball. I think that's not for me. I stick to my lane.
Yeah, this like I don't know, man. Though it's like a guy who is called JYD 2.0. I feel like there might be JYD 3.0. That might be a name that somebody tries to steal for the new Slamball League. This might go down.
Oh yeah. Yeah, for sure.
100%. So how did this come to be, man? Like, obviously, you have the relationship with Bud dating back to your days together in Atlanta. But had this been something that you'd always kind of thought about doing, you being a coach, you wanting to do with Bud? Where did this begin?
Yeah, more in my latter years and with Brooklyn, when I was playing with Brooklyn, and I kind of was, you know, mentoring a lot, you know, from D'Angelo Russell, Spencer Dinwiddie, you know, Terrence LeVert, so on. You know, I just fell in love with the process of, you know, helping them grow, you know, and seeing them achieve and kind of, you know, growing as not only players on the court but off the court. So, you know, when I kind of went through the whole situation with San Antonio and in Houston, and I kind of found myself on the other side of the NBA, this is just something that went through my brain, and I discussed it with a lot of my old former coaches, and they felt good about it, and I felt good about it, and you know, Bud always been a mentor to me, and you know, we talked and we talked for months, and we kind of figured this thing out.
So coaching with someone that used to coach you, probably a little bit of a different feeling there, but are there any parts of Bud's coaching style that you're going to either like try to emulate since you know what he's like, or are you bringing like a completely different perspective when you get on the bench there?
I think it's just one of those things, man. We just going to get in there and every day I just want to grow. You know, I want to be a sponge. I want to understand, you know, his terminology, you know, the culture, all those types of things. So when I get in there, I'm just excited about the opportunity right now. And once I get in there, me and Bud, you know, we will. I know he will help me out in a tremendous way. And it's always been in my tree. You know, my uncle Mike Anderson from St. John's, been a coach. My cousin, he's an assistant coach at St. John's. So it's always been in my blood. So it's just one of those things. I'm ready to get ready to get started the next chapter of my career. And hopefully, man, I can take off with it.
Yeah, I think that's a real compliment to Bud that you would want to join his staff, that you would want to spend more time with him. You know, like a lot of guys end up getting coached by someone. They're like, yep, that's all the time that we have. That'll be all for our relationship. This is pretty interesting. Like, yeah, you want to hang out with the guy. You want to learn from this guy that you chose this guy. And it makes sense because you guys had a ton of success in Atlanta together, right? And I still think back to that year. I think it was 2015 where you guys get in the postseason. You were red hot. Why so many people were excited for you to come to Toronto. And you had the ankle injury with that Hawks team. That's got to be the biggest what if in your career? You know, you don't get hurt in that series. How you guys fare against that team? Because like everybody tested themselves against LeBron, and I was looking back at some of your old numbers. Like I looked at one graphic yesterday. It was like you got, because you were dubbed the LeBron stopper for the Hawks when they played you guys. Yeah. When LeBron played you, he was 8 of 26 from the field, including playoffs. He was 30 of 41 against the rest of the team. Like. You end up getting hurt. It totally changes the series, and it totally changes kind of that Hawks team that everyone had fallen in love with, that sent multiple All-Stars, that had Bud. And it's like you became one of the like first dominoes to basically change that by coming to Toronto.
Oh, yeah. I think back on that all the time. It was unfortunate. You know, it happens. It's the game of basketball. Injuries happen. That's why it's called Next Man Up. Getting hurt, you know, in that series kind of really hindered me. And you know, it kind of prolonged throughout my career, you know, especially my time in Toronto when I got there. I never could shake back from it. I think I retweaked it and it just was not good. So at the end of the day, man, I'm still blessed, you know, to be able to have the opportunity to play the game at a high level for such a long time. I don't regret anything, you know. Everything happens for a reason, but at the same time, you know, sometimes you still hit your head and be like, if I didn't get hurt, what could this all be? But at the end of the day, I'm happy, and I'm ready to move on to the next chapter of my career.
Yeah, and I think it's a pretty – it's always funny, too, because, like, you do get remembered from, you know, your era of playing, and it's a recent era, of being one of the guys that actually had success against LeBron, right? And yeah, you have a career that's independent against that, but I still think about like how it was Ruben Patterson. Remember where he was like the Kobe stoppers? Like Ruben Patterson is the Kobe stopper.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then Kobe was like, I'm going to kill this guy. You know, so right, I was wondering, right, LeBron, right, after that run with the Hawks, when you were with Toronto, did you feel like LeBron, like he knew about that stuff? Was there ever a time where you showed up
and
then he's like, I'm going to make an example of you now because there's a graphic out there that people can reference that says you're good against me?
Yeah, for sure, for sure. I felt like, you know, everybody, it's a small world in the NBA. People know when you're injured. You know, they know when you're hurt. When you're not moving a certain way, you know, when they can attack you. And, you know, LeBron is, you know, one of the best players to ever come through our league, and he studies the game day and night. He's like a player and a coach on the floor. So, of course, you know, you can see when a player is not 100%. So he did right. He did what he should do, you know, being one of the best players. And at the end of the day, you know, I'm just happy to be able to, you know, to be out there and compete at a high level. 12 years.
Yeah, man. You played almost 600 games in the NBA, and it's quite a thing to be the guy that they turn to and say, hey, you've got to D up LeBron for a lot of these possessions. I've always been curious,
yeah,
too,
yeah.
And man, it's like, so LeBron is just there in the East, right? And it was just every year, LeBron, LeBron, LeBron. Okay, he's going to another finals, he's going to another finals. And there were multiple years, too, where we would always have to do the thing of, well, maybe the Cavs aren't quite the Cavs this time around. Maybe LeBron isn't quite LeBron this time around. And was he in the Raps' head? Like, those two teams that you were with, those two runs with the Raptors, 15-16, and 16-17. I always wondered how much it just the psychological effect, because obviously he was a great player, but the whole Raptors organization was about beating him. Like a big part of the reason that you came in, I'm sure Masai Ujiri was pitching you saying, hey, we need you here. We believe that you're a key cog in helping slow this guy down and get over this hump. I wonder if you think that these guys, like those teams, how they were mentally prepared for LeBron, and once he started to just do his thing, how you guys reacted in the moment.
I think we definitely had an opportunity. And, you know, I think just speaking for myself, just the injury bug kind of held me back. It kind of hindered me on a lot of levels. You know, of course, you know, moving laterally, you know, being physical, all those types of things, I couldn't do that I was doing in Atlanta. And, you know, I think for myself, I felt like if I could at least got to 95% or 100%, I think everything would have probably been a little different. But at the end of the day, you know, Masai put that team together, and Masai is one of the, you know, best GMs in this league. So, you know, for him to put that team together, and we obviously have that opportunity to even get where we was at, you know, just speaks volume to him. So, but at the end of the day, man, like I said before, we went to where we went. It just didn't work out. A lot of injury bugs. It's a part of the game. You see it every day. I feel like Boston took advantage of that this year. It's a lot of teams that take advantage of that, the injury bug. And you just got to be healthy, man. If you're healthy, that's good teams and healthy teams to always make it far.
Yeah. You coming to Toronto, there's just a ton of hype, right? There's not a lot of free agents that sign here, especially not marquee ones. And it's like it's not a long history, right? It was like, hey, Turkoglu, there's you. There's not a ton of guys that choose Toronto that are at the very top of the pile. And yeah, I think it was plantar fasciitis you had to start your career, and you mentioned.
I had plantar fasciitis, but my knee, I had kind of shifted cartilage in my knee that kind of, you know, that never got back. Kind of kept my knee swollen for a long period of time. And we couldn't figure out, you know, how to get the swelling out. So it was just day after day after day after day after thing. And eventually when I got to Brooklyn, you know, I kind of shook back and, you know, and I spent the summer just getting super healthy when I got traded to Brooklyn. And you know, it didn't work out like I wanted to in Toronto, but, you know, I'm still blessed because I feel like the opportunity for me to even compete at that high level and then experience Toronto, because a lot of people think Toronto is not a place to go to play in the NBA, but they got the best fans, I feel like, in the NBA. So, you know, Jurassic Park was crazy. So it was one of those things, man. I'm just blessed to be able to experience the whole experience. And if I can pitch to other people, Toronto is definitely a place to play. And, you know, it's very high profile, you know, true professional, great organization. And from the top, from Masai Ujiri to, you know, to the strength coach, everything is great over there. And the fans makes it even more amazing.
Yeah, the organization, that's what you hear just over and over, is top-notch, and they've invested so much more in them, right? Whether it's been new practice facilities, whatever. And it's always been so important to have Masai Ujiri here. Like, there were a lot of rumors about him potentially leaving Toronto, and people rightfully freaked out because he's been, you know, the figurehead for this organization now since he basically arrived. He's been such a strong presence in terms of pushing so many of those facilities, that professionalism, making sure that, you know, everything is dotted down the wire. What was it like getting pitched by him? Like, what was it like, you know, sitting down in a room and Masai Ujiri is there and he's telling you, like, why he thinks you should come to Toronto? Do you remember kind of what his pitch was?
His pitch
other
was,
than money,
you know, it wasn't only money. Masai coming in and being you know, he has that you know, just him coming, you know, from Nigeria and establishing and doing everything he's done as a GM speaks volume. You know, myself going through what I went throughout my whole career, from college, from being shot to, you know, being diagnosed with a rare liver condition, to kind of being able to sit in front of him and be able to negotiate a contract and actually having an opportunity to change me and my family's life. His pitch was just awesome. He was, you know, he was genuine with it, and he kind of let me know, you know, what I could bring to the table and how he was a fan of my game. And you know, I wouldn't change that for the world. Masai Ujiri was really, really straightforward with me. And like I said, he's one of the best GM in this league has ever seen, and they have right now. So, you know, he's a big piece to Toronto. And And I tell him that every time I see him. You know, obviously when I left and he traded me, it wasn't, you know, but being a man and being grown up and understanding the NBA and understanding everything, man, he was a key part of my life. And, you know, I'm always thankful for it.
Yeah, and okay, so clearly you enjoyed the city of Toronto. Clearly you have a lot of respect for Masai Ujiri and the organization. But yeah, when you did leave, we got to bring it up. You said this was your quote. "I wasn't surprised. I knew a lot of things going on last year that didn't come out. This year I feel like a lot of guys didn't trust each other, and a lot of guys, they didn't feel like other guys could produce or given the opportunity. There was a lack of trust on our team. That's what hindered us from going." That's the end of the quote. Is there something where you look back on Toronto now? Like, what did you mean by that at the time? Like, what was the lack of trust? Did you feel like your role wasn't getting enough looks, that it was, like, too top-heavy with the team with DeMar and Kyle? Like, what kind of made you feel that way when you left?
I think the biggest thing was it was just an emotional quote. You know, at the time, you know, you could look around the room. You know, when I look as a player, you could look around the room. You could make, you know, a lot of assumptions. You could think a lot of ways. But it was definitely an emotional quote. And I had to take fully blame for that. But at the end of the day, I think that team was great. I think we had a shot. We had an opportunity. We didn't take advantage of our opportunity. And that's what the NBA is about, taking advantage of your opportunity. And, you know, I take fully responsibility for that quote because it was kind of an emotional quote. And as a player, you go through ups and downs emotionally, especially when you're injured. But at the end of the day, like I said before, when I look back on it, I'm blessed about the opportunity. And I'm just happy I was part of a Toronto franchise that's, you know, that's high professional and high profile.
You know what, though, man? I love when guys say those things. Like, that, a lot of times this fan base gets accused of being, like, overly sensitive, especially they do get hit with different things, right? Being the only Canadian franchise. Like, I'm sure you saw, was it Chris Broussard? I can't remember who it was recently that said the thing about players that don't want to play in Toronto. And so, like, there's an added level of defensiveness that the fan base has, being the only, like, real other, right? It's the same thing with, like, football fans that are on the West Coast or hockey fans in this country that are on the West Coast, where it's like they feel overlooked, they feel kind of slighted. But I love when players just kind of tell it, like, the way that it is and the way that it feels for them at the time. So, yeah, you can look back on it and be like, hey, this was an emotional period. But it's like, good, cool, you have that on record, that you actually felt some way about leaving Toronto, that you didn't have, you know, business that was settled. You mentioned it. You were hurt basically a lot of your time here, and you never felt like your knee got right. And, yeah, you move off of a team that was kind of there around the mix, had championship aspirations, and they trade you, and you're pissed. Like, I just think that that's fine. You know, like, that's a thing where you look back on and go, Seth, everything makes sense in that. It's like, you wouldn't be Damari Carroll if you weren't pissed off getting traded from a team that didn't think that you could still win.
There you go. Yeah. It was just emotional. It was one of those emotional things. And you know, I just could never shake that knee back to get right like I wanted to. Just the swelling and obviously you can even ask my family and my wife. When I used to come home, I used to just stay up to 3-4 in the morning just trying to get that swelling out. It just never could get right. But those are things behind closed doors a lot of, you know, fans don't see that goes on. But we still get paid to perform at a high level and to try to get out there and do what we need to do. But at that time, I was just emotional. And I feel like, you know, sometimes you have those things emotionally and you say things that sometimes you got to go back and hopefully you get an opportunity to fix. But one of those things, I was just emotional and we lost and we was at such a high level. So many people had us going very far and we kind of let them down. And I just kind of started talking and babbling and that's what happens, you know, when you're young and you're emotional. And things don't work out.
Yeah, I just wondered if it did run deeper because, again, that team was very much just like that was DeMar and Kyle's team. And it felt like, okay, if it's running through them and it's everybody else. And I always wonder, like, yeah, you're a high target free agent acquisition. You had played in a place in Atlanta where it was very much like, hey, everybody shares the ball. Everybody gets touches. One night it's this guy's night. One night it's Teague. One night it's Korver. One night it's Carroll. You know what I mean? Like, it was very much.
Yeah.
I think that what that year four guys made the All-Star team that one season. And it was just a different style of team. And so I just always wondered if that was kind of maybe what had bothered you when I read that quote was, oh man, this guy's used to very much, you know, and you're going back with Bud, right? Although it's kind of funny now with going to that team because it's like, yeah, of course you share the ball, but so much of it is like, yeah, give it to Giannis and he's huge. He's going to just like take it to the rack. And how the hell do you stop that? Good luck. Stand in front of it, especially in transition. But like, how big of an adjustment was it for you to go from that team in Atlanta where, like I said, there was more of a just like group meritocracy to a team in Toronto where it was very much more like isolation heavy?
You know, it was definitely a challenge. But at the end of the day, you know, you go to different teams, you go to different systems. Some systems work for players. Some systems don't work for players. It's just part of the NBA, you know. You've seen a lot of guys over the years that go from certain teams and go to other teams and you wonder why it doesn't work. It's not just because the player just fell off. Sometimes it could be injury. Sometimes it could be the system. You know, it's different things that play a part into sometimes how a player performs. But at the end of the day, like we're paid a lot of money to perform at a high level. So we can't look at nobody or make excuses. You know, we just got to get the job done. And this comes with it. You know, fans not being happy, you know, Instagram tweets, all those types of things come with it. Bad social media, all that. So you got to take it with a grain of salt. I always pride myself on being a strong individual, you know, just being through what I went through my whole career, and from being a journeyman to finally being a starter to, you know, college, you know, like I said before, getting shy to going to the Elite Eight Missouri. I had a heck of a career. So I'm very blessed to be where I'm at now. And just to be able to go and share my story with a lot of these guys coaching is what I really want to do and how I really want to jump into the coaching world, because I think I have a voice. And I want to express my voice. And I think going with Coach Bud, being my mentor my whole career, I think this gives me a great opportunity.
Well, I was going to say, too, yeah, your career is essentially just starting. I think that's always a tough one for athletes. Hey, what am I going to do? For you, you know what you do. It seems like you have a very clear purpose. And I think all those things that you mentioned, all those different perspectives that you've had from playing in the league for so long and having a variety of different roles, having all those different ups and downs, yeah, I think that's probably going to suit you quite well in terms of being able to, yeah, share those experiences and be able to relate to a lot of guys. Probably not Giannis, though. Probably tough to relate to him where you're like, yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
It's like, yeah, you just do your own thing, Giannis. You're just, you're kind of a different breed of what I was used to. Damari Carroll, thanks for coming on this morning, man. We appreciate it, and congrats on the new gig, man.
I appreciate you all, always.
Take care. Damari Carroll, former Raptors forward, current Milwaukee Bucks assistant coach. That was fun. Let's take a break. Let's keep the good times rolling. Been a while since spoke to our next guest. Dan Shulman. Yes. Next on the Fan Morning Show, JD and Ailish, Sports at 590 The Fan.